it will likely be 99 no's before you get a yes. But then you're gonna learn from all those no's, and next time you're gonna get 49 no's before you get a yes. And later on you get 9 no's and you get a yes. And if you keep on improving your sales process, the conversations you have, the caliber of people you have them with, you start getting more yeses than no's eventually.
Welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the co-founder and CEO at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's purchasing with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've invited someone along who has managed to create a fractional CFO firm that has grown by 50% or more for more than 10 years on the trot. And you don't have to be Warren Buffett to figure out that that rate of compounding growth is extremely unusual, especially for a services business and especially for fractional or CFO business, and has to be one of the leading firms in the world at this stage at that growth rate. Lo Barnard from Outsource CFO, I'm going to learn from you today about maybe how the listeners can copy your success easily. So maybe you could just give us a bit of background as to what led you to this point here.
James, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be on the podcast. Really appreciate the time and the interest in our journey as entrepreneurs and finance people. It's been a road up to this point. I wanted to be an entrepreneur since I was 6 years old, and I had my first entrepreneurship day at school. Long story for another day. But I always had in my heart, like, creating companies and building something from scratch would be a really exciting career choice. I deviated from that through studies, going into the accounting route, following my dad into the chartered accountant route in South Africa, which I thought would be a good baseline foundation to gain business and financial skills that you can take into commerce and into entrepreneurship. And we then did just that. And in our third year of articles, kind of 7 years into this study and articles journey that you need to become a CA, we went to a startup grind event in Cape Town. I think it was the very first one ever. And a successful entrepreneur was put on stage and they were interviewed about their journey with their company. And the interesting thing for us was there were about 70 or so entrepreneurs in the room. Everyone had started their own businesses at some stage or were just about to start, but there was not a single accountant in the room. So we thought, whoa, someone has to be the accountant for all these startups, for all these entrepreneurs who will probably make loads of financial and tax and structuring mistakes if they don't have someone finance in the room. Because what you often get is this is the side of the spectrum that an accountant personality profile sits. And an entrepreneur probably sits on the opposite side of that spectrum. You know, go-getter, hustler, salesperson, marketer, software engineer, design things, build things, create things, break things on this side. An accountant is more, you know, kind of like within the box, create structure, framework, bring down risk, etc. And if you put those two things together, you can actually build a really great company. So we saw that in some of our audit clients when we were doing our articles, like the guys who had brought on finance people into their teams early on were the most successful. So we said, we'll be the chartered accountant, finance professionals who jump in with these startups, roll up our sleeves and help the guys actually build good businesses. And that was basically where it started. When we were 25 years old, we got into an incubator process and just launched the business with no clients, no network, no funding, no clue what we were doing. But we believed in our hearts there was something to this thing in the market, even though we hadn't seen something like it before.
A good friend of mine came to me today and said, James, I'm going to start a business where my customers are all broke and they're scatological. They're all over the place, manic in many cases. They have no resources behind them. And I'm going to build my fortune as having my customer. I'd say you're mad. And that sounds exactly what you tried to do with entrepreneurs. Speaking as an entrepreneur, I can self-identify. So how do you pick out the wheat from the chaff? There's a lot of people with a business idea, but not everyone is actually going to make that real. So how did you avoid just having your time wasted by a bunch of people who are basically just going nowhere?
So I wish I had a magical answer for that. But I think the short of the long is we didn't. We learned by trying. We had many meetings and tried many things with early stage companies and people who wanted to start a business who just really couldn't at that stage afford it, to be honest. We learned over many trial and error periods that maybe kind of early stage scale up is a better place to start playing. When you work with a company who has maybe at least 5 or 10 people in the business who are turning at least a handful of million rands, I guess, in our case, or getting closer to $1 million in turnover, those kind of companies really often don't yet have a full-time finance team in-house, but they have a bit of a budget for it. So they can actually afford to start investing in their accounting and finance and reporting functions. Because if I guess if you're earlier stage than that, if you really don't have turnover yet and you're unfunded, it is really tough to be able to afford expensive-ish finance resources in the business. So I guess naturally we move to guys who are either had seed or Series A level funding in the business, so funded startups in their early stages, or guys who are a little bit later stage, maybe 3, 4, 5 years in, who've got a bit of a business going. There's something to do financial engineering on. If you really haven't got your first customer yet and you haven't got money in the bank, it's quite hard for a finance person to do that much in the business. But when you are moving, there's a lot of data that we can gather, information we can put together, and strategies we can start deploying to make the business grow faster on the top end and to make it more efficient, to bring out more on the bottom end, and to then start attracting different opportunities for capital into the business to move things faster. But if you're still in the starting blocks as an entrepreneur, you have to hustle to figure out how to get out of those starting blocks so you can get to a point where I think it would make sense to bring a finance person or a fractional finance team on board.
What's different about how you acquire customers today versus back in the early days? Like, you still go to the startup events?
We do go to some events. It's really good to keep getting market feedback in terms of like how established is the brand? What are people saying about the business? It's really interesting. I do definitely still go to an event every month or so. Definitely not pounding the pavement we used to. I think in our first kind of 6 months of business, there would have been four or five startup events every week that you could go to in some shape or form. And we went to all of them, not only for the free beer and food, but also for the network and trying to find who can you find who can be or can refer your next client to you, which in that case was kind of close to the first clients. I think it's difficult if you have no reputation and no track record and no clients to reference. Obviously, finding someone who's going to use your product or service is a hell of a lot harder. So I think resilience and learning fast, they are the most important things in this phase. Speak to as many people you can who could potentially be a client and test your product or service against them at this price point that you are thinking is a good idea, and see what comes back. It will likely be 99 no's before you get a yes. But then you're going to learn from all those no's, and next time you're going to get 49 no's before you get a yes. And later on, you get 9 no's and you get a yes. And if you keep on improving your sales process, the conversations you have, the caliber of people you have them with, you start getting more yeses than no's eventually. And I think once you get there, then you have enough learnings to build a framework for sales. What is the ideal process to take a client through the experience of coming on board with your product or service? Then you can start hiring a sales team. At the moment, we have a head of growth, a senior sales manager, and then a team of sales consultants who all do the sales. So as leads and referrals come in, they have about 30, 40 different meetings a week with new prospects. All those prospects are taken through a problem solution journey with the sales team, and they get onboarded through digital contracts directly into the client-facing teams. We have 4 different client-facing divisions. So they get plugged into the head of department of the client-facing division and contracted into the process. So at the moment, I'm absolutely not involved in sales. I don't speak to prospects really. But I think in the early days, the only person who can convince someone of the value of what you offer is you. And no one will ever be able to do that better than you, most likely, because you start the business. So you have that passion for what you're doing, what you believe it can solve. So I think one has to stay close to the heartbeat. And there's different phases where you have to initially become a salesperson. You have to learn the skills to market and sell what you offer. If you can't sell to someone, you can have the best product in the world, no one's going to be able to buy it because you're not selling. So that's a big early skill to double down on.
So you've particularly leveraged business competitions, I'm going to call them, like 35 under 35, you see there in South Africa, where you were, you know, there's a lot of organizations out there willing to help people who want to get started. I guess you didn't fit the profile, am I wrong? Like, normally those startups are like tech businesses or biotech, but you managed to sell a story that meant that you were able to build your professional services business into these business competitions. So how did you manage to do that? And is that still an opportunity, or is that boat sailed?
So we were quite lucky. In our second year of business, Microsoft BizSparks became a big client of ours. nationally. That was a startups program that Microsoft funded for the whole country. And about 1,000 startups went into this program where they got mentoring support and incubation support and shared services. And we got to work with about the top 100 of those 1,000 startups in South Africa, where Microsoft then fit the bill for our consulting hours to work with these startups. It was really like a pivotal moment in our early journey. So because we were working with so many different tech companies, we actually learned the tech company business model quite well in year 2 and 3 in Outsource CFO. And we said, we don't want to build a traditional finance and accounting firm. We want to see how we can morph the best things of professional financial services with the best things of a tech company. So we love the free cash flow, no capital required, fixed monthly recurring revenue that finance elements can have. But we also like the fast pace, the disruptiveness, the leadership strategies and tactics of a tech company. So we've always tried to morph those two into one business model, which made us quite unique because no one really does that. Tech companies don't do professional financial services, and finance people don't tend to think like tech companies or build their businesses in the same way. So I think that made us quite unique and quite interesting for some of these entrepreneur programs, where with the Entrepreneur of the Year competition, we actually managed to win that against two companies that were much bigger than us at the time. Because we also, our service inherently serves entrepreneurs to build better companies as well. For an entrepreneurship competition, then that is quite an interesting thing. So I think we got lucky with a few. I think we also spent a lot of time doing good applications for some others and made some good cases of why we think this business is worth speaking about. And I guess for me, always just the idea of like, the more people are talking about, who are talking about your brand and your business and you, the more potential there is out there in the world for a referral to come your way, for a client to think of you when it's actually time for them to find a solution in their company at the right stage for their finance function. So we always try to just kind of like create energy and enthusiasm and chatter in the market in lots of different ways. And these competitions have always just been one of the channels, like the top 35, under 35 with our Chartered Accountancy Institute, goes out to tens of thousands of these chartered accountants. Many of them are CFOs in mid-sized and larger organizations who then could potentially become clients. Many of them are also some of the top young talent in the country who inevitably want to come and work for us. So I think a lot of people have just kind of seen the business over the years. I was in 3 different years with cohorts and won the leadership category in the last time I applied. And my co-founder was also in one of them. So I think of the 10 years of the competition, Outsource CFO was on the stage 4 times. I don't think they'll let that happen again, but we joined early, I guess. Just then goes out to the entire industry through a marketing bullhorn that's much, much bigger than what our little one would be in our kind of like startup business, which is useful. Conversations come to you first if your name is out there the most.
You can make a very good case for yourself, and sometimes you can make a lot of progress with a little bit of effort by actually choosing to compete in these things and get going with them. You know, you're naturally, you seem very high energy. Maybe we'll talk about EOS a little bit, since Chris Goldman introduced us together. I believe we wrote Run EOS. As the business matured, maybe you could just give people a little flavor of what EOS is and at what scale you decided, oh, we need to something like this to help us to build.
When a company is maybe under 10 or under 20 people, the founder or the founders really can still control the entire narrative. You can have a relationship with everyone in your team. You can have conversations with everyone in your team every day. You can put everyone in the same room if you like, if you're physically in the office every day. I guess maybe until 10 to 20, depending on how good and natural a communicator you are, I think you can run it like that, and it will run it in accordance with your plans and vision and in accordance with your core values. But I think when it starts getting a little bit bigger than that, you need some kind of a framework to make the business more exponential and build it in a way that it can stand and work in its entirety and in its different pieces apart from you. So this is at this stage where something like entrepreneur organizations program was a game changer for us. We joined EO Accelerator maybe about in our 3rd year, so just before we turned 4 years old, I think, we hit the threshold. EO Accelerator launched in Cape Town, and it's an accelerator program that runs for, you go to 2 or 3 annual cycles of the program. It's part of entrepreneur organization that's this global network of 19,000 entrepreneurs in 220 cities around the world who have $1 million plus turnover in their companies and who are actively scaling their businesses. So at a quarter of that turnover level, you can get into the accelerator program. And then they teach you how to build a $1 million plus company. And the framework they teach is called Scaling Up by their founder, Vern Harnish. It's a very deep, quite complex, but amazing handbook on how to scale a business. And we started deploying certain elements of that in our company. And a little bit later on, found Traction and the EOS system, the Entrepreneurial Operating System, which draws from Scaling Up and from Jim Collins and from a couple of, I think, from eMyth Revisited and a few other frameworks. And they create kind of 20 tools that get you 80% of the results. So EOS, you can implement in 6 months in your business easily. And it runs really well. It covers all the major elements of your vision, values, framework, your operating system, how you execute and operate and what processes you run, how you build your team and manage your team, and how you create strategy at the end of the day to make sure the company keeps skyrocketing. If one finds one of those frameworks and you double down on it, you really take it in, you test things, and you build every quarter, you build certain pieces into the business, eventually it can start running more and more without you, where you can extract yourself from certain divisions within the business and put a capable leader in there because things are already working there. We spoke about the sales process earlier, kind of like in year 1, 2, and 3, you are sales. And eventually kind of if sales starts running quite well and there's a good repeatable process, you can get a sales manager that can take that over. And they also then learn and get better. And eventually if they do sales for 40 plus hours a week, every week, they're going to get, you know, as good as you or better than you. My head of growth is way better than me at sales at this stage of the fight. But I think that then you kind of like take every division within your business, every core function, and scale it up.
I'm curious because you clearly invest quite heavily in terms of your marketing, and that's helped you to grow the business. How does your model work? How much would you recommend people invest in their marketing versus sales function as they grow at different levels? You know, how have you got to your level and what sort of resources do you put into marketing today?
I think it depends on what you want to do, right? There's a difference between building a good and profitable owner-run business. You take out a decent profit, you earn a good salary, you run a small or mid-sized team, and it makes for a decent life. It's different to scaling up an organization. If you want to build a larger organization, it's quite a different framework. And it also depends on whether you're going to fuel your growth with capital or not with external capital. And like we bootstrapped our business throughout all of its phases, which is, I guess, a slower growth process than you would if you put millions of dollars of growth capital into it fairly early on.
I mean, 50% of the year is not slow by any measure, right? So
we're lucky in that with it being a services business with a completely online delivery and process flow for its operations, it is fairly low cost and to run. Like it isn't capital intensive, like you have to build this, you know, millions of dollars of software before you can start going to clients, or you have to, you know, buy millions of dollars worth of inventory or machinery or something of the sort. So it's quite lean. And we've created a cash flow cycle for it that's negative 16 days. So we invoice on the 1st, collect debit orders on the 15th, pay costs on the 25th and the 30th of the month. So the more we grow, the more operational capital the company creates internally. So those kind of things really help us with it. Capital is not core constraint. Talent and client acquisition are the two major things you need to continuously solve. But your question around marketing and sales, I would say on average, between 8 and 12% of sales is what companies in our industry of different size, shapes and sizes spend on marketing and sales as a function. So I would say do your numbers on what is sales right now for you. And let's say 10% is the middle of that. If you want to grow, if you want to build a brand and add new clients fast, at least 10% of what you bring in top line has to go into your marketing and sales engine. So that's always been, we've always kind of like played between kind of like probably between 10 and 12%, taking a big portion of our margin, which otherwise would have been profit, and plowing that into marketing and sales efforts because that makes the business bigger. Yeah, you know, if you have a let's call it a $1 million company that has a 30% margin versus maybe a $5 million company on a 10% margin, you're still going to make a lot more and on the bigger one, and you have a lot more leverage because you can stop your sales and marketing year and go up to a larger margin year when you are ready. For us, our preference was always, how do we first create scale? Like, let's build a team for us, kind of like it was in the at least 100-man team. We're in the process of building a 1,000-man organization. Our big, hairy, audacious goal is to reach 10,000 entrepreneurial clients, and build a team of 1,000 professionals is our big 25-year goal with the organization. So all of our decisions are informed by that. We want to run profitably with good free cash flow, but we also want to grow as aggressively as we can because our mission is to reach entrepreneurs and hire and create meaningful work for more people. And we can only do that if we grow fast, and the faster we can responsibly grow, the quicker we can make a big impact through those things. So I would say kind of like take your 10% of your sales, split it in half and say half of this goes to my marketing engine, half of it goes to sales. What is that budget? And what are the tactics and tools you can start deploying? We have, I think, 13 different channels through marketing that we look at. There's social media marketing, there's video, there's competitions, there's events, there's search engine optimization, there's blog content, there's a whole bunch of different things for which we have specialists for every single one of those things under a marketing manager in our growth department. Like, we spend hundreds of thousands a month on marketing and sales efforts, which then in turn just bring in the new clients. We have, you know, every, I think we're signing clients at about 1 to 2 per business day at the moment. We're adding new clients because of this marketing and sales machine. You know, five to 12 clients a week come on board with the organization.
I feel like South Africa is my secret weapon when it comes to acquiring international customers, especially when it comes to marketing. They have some of the finest advertising schools in the world. AAA is one of them. You know, there's Joe Public, some great advertising agencies. Do you bring that expertise in-house, or do you have in-house people work with agencies locally there?
When we were really small, you can't hire someone good that does it. So then you get a marketing agency who brings in a couple of those core skills on a fractional basis, almost like what our service would be to a smaller business. And you learn from them. As soon as you realize that budget now, remember your sales is growing as you get bigger, so your number you can spend on marketing gets bigger. So now when you hit a point where you're spending more with your outsourced marketing firm than what you could if you hired an internal marketing manager, that might be a trigger point where you'd say, okay, maybe I should consider finding an up-and-coming marketing manager who can do a good couple of the things that they do currently and replace them by hiring full-time, because in 5 different areas, they're giving me, let's call it 40 hours a month of time, whereas if I bring it in-house, I might get a full-time person for that amount. Now, granted, you'll never get someone who understands absolutely everything in marketing, right? The person who's a deep SEO expert might not love social media creativity, might not be a good videographer, might not everything else. Same with finance, right? Your great CFO isn't going to do your bookkeeping and vice versa. So you build as you move. So what we did, we kind of like originally started with a junior person in-house and external consulting businesses that brought in the expertise. And then we got quite a strong marketing manager who could run with marketing. And we kept the different service providers. Like, we have the 13 different pillars of marketing. We have an expert firm for each one of those who help run with our marketing department and our marketing juniors internally. And as we get big enough, then, you know, if you see, what we spend on our website every month is more than what a salary for a website kind of SEO expert would be, you'll probably take that in-house and say, let's hire a full-time person. And you kind of like, that's how you build the marketing engine in-house over time, which is the same way you build an operation engine and the sales engine and everything else through the different phases.
In the early days, when 12% of a smaller number is like, let's say, okay, that's the price of a lawnmower, no problem, I'll spend that. I'd rather have some marketing than a lawnmower. And then maybe one day it becomes a small car, and then another day it's actually quite a nice car. And then you're looking at spending maybe a price of a small apartment on your marketing. Have you dealt with that personally? And when your clients are facing this point in their business, when the figures get bigger, it starts to become more zeros on the end. Maybe there's an emotional component. You're suddenly feeling like, especially if you're fully funded the business yourself, is your money going out the door? How do you deal with founders who have to decide about what to take out versus reinvest? How do you talk them through that decision?
I guess, again, it depends on the strategy. You'd have to look at the shareholders. What is their expectation? Like, what is their phase of life? Are they looking for, you know, a return right now, or are they looking at a bigger return in the future? Because those are probably going to cut way against each other. If you put more into marketing and sales now, you can get bigger and you can have a more exponential future. But you're not going to make that margin while you spend it on marketing and sales all the way there. Whereas if you're happy to grow kind of like slower and more organic, you can take out more margin as you move. But you're never going to get this kind of an exit or to this kind of a profitability level if you're that big, because you just simply haven't done the scale. So for us, because we were, when we started when we were 25, unmarried with no children, the bunch of us three co-founders, like, we've always had a very long-term view on it. We didn't need to necessarily take out much. We never earned a proper market salary. We were only articles clerks for 3 years. So we got used to kind of like compromising on earnings to build something we believe in and that we know will have a lot of value in future. So for us, that was quite an easy decision to say, like, look, we still want to maintain a small margin in the business. We still want to be able to pay dividends and earn a good market-related salary, maybe not in year one or year two or year three, but somewhere downstream, you get to a point where you get to, you know, repetitive dividends and a good market-related salary for the work you do.
You're 10 years into the business now. I mean, that's a lot of work, Lo. You put in the hours, you know. Do you still feel as good about just putting more money back into the bucket as you did on day one, or has your opinion changed over time?
No, super happy. So we are, you know, at 10% of our growth goal in terms of our BHAG. So we've got a lot of scaling up to do. We will keep reinvesting in the business over the years. We are taking out a decent margin at the moment. We're keeping it kind of at a steady kind of 10 or slightly above 10% profit margin. Where we're sitting at the moment, if you pay a proportion of that, you put in your vault, a proportion of that you put in your pocket, to take it off the table. Because we have reached a certain scale, 5% of turnover is actually quite an interesting number by now. It's a small percentage because we're reinvesting a lot, but because of the investment, we've gotten so big. So a small percentage of a big pie is actually quite nice. Yeah, so it's again, just the personal preferences, needs, life stages of the founder and or shareholders that will dictate what you go for.
Got two questions for you, but one is, who is your business hero and why?
Someone that I feel I have quite a soft spot for is probably Richard Branson. What he has managed to achieve in one lifetime, I don't know if it's the case anymore, but at one stage he had 10 billion dollar companies in his group. I'm not sure. Some of them may have gotten bigger and some of them may have dived below that. But nonetheless, he's created an absolute beast of an organization in his Virgin Group. And in his later life now, kind of his way into his 70s, I think, he still says he's doing the most meaningful work of his life now through their foundation. Because he's created that scale, there's now such a massive impact that can be created through their nonprofit efforts in the group. So I love his heart. I love his thinking. I love his craziness. Entrepreneurs, like you mentioned in the beginning, are often crazy. And also, I guess we've had the privilege of spending a little bit of time with him. He has a wine estate in South Africa and quite a lot of ties to the country. And maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago now, the Branson Center for Entrepreneurship became a client of ours in South Africa. So they have a foundation in the country that serves early stage entrepreneurs in different kind of ways. And that foundation and some of its projects that are all in our portfolio. We service the group. We went to the launch of this foundation, I think it must be about 6 years ago, and actually got to meet Richard and spend a couple of minutes with the man on his estate at that function. And he was really lovely. He was what the package says it is. Spoke to me and my wife with such interest and such enthusiasm about our little businesses that we had. That it was just, yeah, it was very, very validating for me to see this great entrepreneur taking interest in these youngsters in the early days with their different ventures.
I'm not sure I'd want to be Elon Musk. Like, he seems like a pretty manic existence. Richard Branson certainly seems to love his life and enjoy it, as well as doing all the other things. Yeah.
If you look at Richard in terms of his family, his kids, his how he's having fun, I really aspire to that kind of life design, which is, I think, the opposite of what a Musk kind of profile would do. Financially, one of the most successful entrepreneurs in the world, but, you know, at quite some significant costs that I am not willing to pay on my journey.
Okay, so congratulations on getting OCFO.com. I'm sure that was not cheap. I'm graduating into more international purview now.
So, funny story, it was super cheap. Someone sold it to us for $1,000 in the first month of COVID. It was a miracle. It should cost about $1 million by valuation.
If you told me $1 million, I would have been not surprised. So genius. I love the hustle. You got it.
I put a bid in, the minimum bid on the platform, just to get a conversation going with the agent and the owner, and they released it and we bought it. March 2020, it was an absolute miracle.
Wow, boom, brilliant. Well, it makes you look like a rock star because that's a great domain. Who's the ideal customer for you today? I know you work in South Africa, but internationally as well. Like, who would be the chef's kiss, ideal customer to listen to this and know to reach out to you to start working with you?
That's always a hard question for me to answer. We've got four different client-facing divisions, and they've all got a different ideal client profile. And they all have, call it a small mid-sized business focus in one way, as well as somewhat of a corporate focus in the other way. So kind of the core offering for the CFO and the accounting divisions would be, I'd say, kind of an EO entrepreneur style business. One business in the group is maybe $1 million or a few million dollars in turnover. It's not massive yet, so it needs external finance input, fractional professionals who can come build the accounting systems, accounting processes, CFO function elements within the business who can help capitalize and grow the company. Those are great, fractional accounting team, fractional CFO services offering clients. We have also in the last few years been finding really good revenue growth in, let's call it, enterprise level clients, maybe people with organizations with like 1,000 or 2,000 people, where there's a 50-man finance team who simply can't keep up with their rate of growth, their rate of acquisitions, the chaos in the business, maybe the rate at which people are leaving in the finance team. There's a very big talent shortage across most parts of the world for accountants. The US and the UK particularly really struggle to find good accounting talent. Not enough young people have qualified as professional accountants in the last 10 years because they thought accounting was going out of fashion. And the interesting thing is accountants have become more in fashion than ever before, I think, because we can actually really now not just crunch the numbers, but actually add the value to organizations, which our brains were designed for, I think, originally.
The role has expanded, especially here in Europe with the ESG agenda. They've taken on new responsibilities when it comes to environmental reporting. That's a big thing. Obviously, people are now getting ahead and starting to understand the importance of finance to actually driving the business. You know, many of the CFOs I speak with, accountancy is table stakes. And then there's the learning how to drive and create the right KPIs in a business to drive growth. And once you do that, that's what you need to get beyond the 20, 30 people stage we were talking about earlier to what you are today. So maybe you just wrap up with that. Tell us how many people are in your organization today and how can people get in touch with you?
So we're a little bit over 100 at the moment in Outsource CFO. So ocfo.com is probably the best place to find us. There's a contact page there. My personal LinkedIn page is also a great spot to find us. If you follow my story on there, I try to share most of our business journey on there in a structured way. A direct message there will always get answered. An inbox in ocfo.com will always go to our head of talent, which is quite useful, or to the growth team if it's a client inquiry. And it's probably a good place to find out more across social media or on the website.
Well, if you're still listening to the podcast at this stage, I can recommend, looking at South Africa in terms of talent. It's a superpower that I've had. We have a team there in the Eastern Cape, and there's a lot of really hardworking, highly educated, driven people. And if you're not taking advantage of them in this international economy, then I think you're missing a trick. Also, if you're still listening, congratulations. Your bonus is to be able to sign up for our newsletter at procurementexpress.com/newsletter, where you'll get to update it on podcasts just like this on a weekly basis with interviews with leading finance, software and professionals in their industries. Hopefully we pitch it at a level where it's information that's practical enough for you to be able to use in your day-to-day job. It's not too esoteric. It's a bit more hands-on. And congratulations, you've qualified to join the newsletter. So go and do it now. Lo, thank you very much for making the time for being with us today. I know you're super busy and thanks for joining the pod.
James, thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it and good luck with all the good work you're doing.